This interview is with Marilyn White, who is a member of the First Congregational United Church of Christ. Marilyn has been a resident of Moorhead since 1926. This interview was held at Marilyn's home at 1014 13th Street South in Moorhead on April 11, 1985. The interviewer is Bonnie Wagner, representing the Heritage Education Commission. Moorhead has a large number of churches of various denominations, sizes, and ages. Many changes have come about in the churches during the past 50 years, many of these reflecting the economic and sociological changes of the times. Marilyn, when did you become a member of your church and why?
Well, Bonnie, I can say that I almost date back past the 50-year mark that we're talking about in Moorhead, because I became first associated with the church at the time my folks joined in 1926, when they moved here from Missouri. I might say that I guess it was a combination choice for them in churches, because my dad was of Presbyterian background and my mother from Methodist background, and upon visiting the churches in town, they decided that this one was most compatible for both of them, and joined it. So they found that to be, the church. I grew up in that church and stayed with it, with the exception of 8 years when I lived away from Moorhead. I grew up then in the church, and also we went to college in Moorhead, at Moorhead State University. And in 1949, married a church member, fellow church member, Norm Fay, who had just gotten back from World War II service. My husband and I were active in the church for the next 22 years, and during that course of time, we had 5 children. The oldest 4 children were baptized and confirmed to membership in the Moorhead Church. Then in 1971, my husband and I were divorced, and I left Moorhead to take a teaching job in Lisbon, North Dakota. When I moved there, I joined the Presbyterian Church, and my youngest 2 children were with me then. And the youngest was confirmed in the Lisbon Presbyterian Church. At that time, then I spent 4 years there, and in 1977 moved to Waconia, Minnesota, where I took another teaching job, and for the next 4 years was a member of the Excelsior Congregational Church. Bonnie was still with me then, and in 1980 I was remarried to Leland White and moved back to Moorhead, at which time we both joined the Congregational Church, me for the second time, and Lee transferring from the Methodist Church in Moorhead.
Marilyn, can you tell us a little bit about the organization of your congregation in Moorhead?
Yes, actually the congregation began in 1894, and there are several families in the church today whose ancestors go back to those early years. And the first minister was the then president of Fargo College, which is no longer in existence now. And the sanctuary, the older front portion of the church building, was dedicated in 1901, built on lots purchased by the Ladies Union, and made possible in part by a $3,000 grant from our state conference. A parsonage was built to the south of the church in 1913, which no longer exists. That building was torn down many years ago. In 1952, an extensive remodeling project was completed during the latter years of Reverend Newton Cruz's ministry here. Designed by M.O. Foss, Jr., this remodeling shifted and enlarged the chancel, added the lounge, offices, and classrooms on the upper level, and on the lower level, tripled the size of the fellowship hall and kitchen space, as well as made added classrooms there. More recently, the a parsonage was built, and in recent years now that has been sold, and a kind of a new premise that many churches are doing anyway. The minister is allowed to, and has a housing allowance, and so the church no longer owns a residence.
I know that education has always been an important part of your life. When you were first attending religious classes in those early years, can you tell us a little bit about that, and then perhaps how things have changed over the years?
Yes, Bonnie. I guess one of my earlier reminiscences about church education is the fact that we were a smaller church and so on in facility, and the earliest classes that we had were just what you'd call bumper to bumper. In other words, we had little round tables in the basement, and each class was about 3 feet from another class. And then we were even into the little balcony over the sanctuary, and even the tower room where there's a church bell and so on. I remember every nook and cranny was occupied. And I didn't think of it as being super distracting in those days, but I realize it really was, as far as the teaching situation is concerned. Now we have, of course, you know, much better classroom situations. And I was growing up in the days when the Congregational Church didn't traditionally have a long confirmation program, such as many of our Lutheran churches in town have, and so on. So when I was growing up, they began to think they should have such a thing, and I was in one of the very beginning classes, some were in the late 30s, early 40s, where the confirmation training was about 6 weeks long. Since then it has evolved into, you know, at least a year-long program, and sometimes 2 years in the junior high ages. But though the church growth kind of paralleled that of Moorhead in a way, I suppose, but it was a small town when I was growing up, and then in the immediate post-war years expanded, and the church population did also, which I explained before that it culminated in the building project in 1952, where they gained a lot in the way of education rooms particularly. And I also remember in the early days that had some of the first church camp experiences. We usually rented some other church facilities, such as the Northern Pines camp that the Methodists own over at Park Rapids. Our groups went there in the summers. And then subsequently in about 1960, I think, the state conference of the Congregational Church bought Pilgrim Point at Alexandria, Minnesota. So since that time, they've operated their own camp.
In going back to your description of your crowded conditions when Sunday school was going on a long time ago, I suppose that you've noticed too that there's a great deal of difference in the materials that were used. For instance, the books and the teachers' aids and helps for the students. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yes, I guess I could respond there. The church publishing house, or, you know, companies have always put out some materials, but they were really quite limited in the books that they had. And today, you know, we have quite a few things in the audiovisual department. And really today, or is quite long-standing now, that the materials are pretty ecumenical, because the joint publishing house puts out material for the Congregational, Methodist, Episcopal, Presbyterian, so that actually we have quite a wide variety and wealth of materials compared to what we used to have to operate with. I guess I was thinking that when I was telling about my growing up in the church, I didn't mention my folks' involvement too. My dad was superintendent of Sunday school and long time involved with that area also. And Then in the education line, I wanted to mention that for a long period into the 50s, and the churches in Fargo-Moorhead had an organization which sponsored interchurch leadership training, and this was held in the wintertime. They alternated going from one church to another and involved the staffs of many of the churches. They not only involved, for instance, just the, what we call the liberal Protestant groups, but even the Jewish community and others who would contribute as leaders and resource people to run that school. And it was really, I'd call, a predecessor to the present Communiversity, because that finally developed out of this kind of thing, that, and this is now held in February every year at Concordia College. Another aspect of religious training in those days was released time school. From the time I was in grade school, I do remember going to these. We at that time cooperated with the Methodist and Presbyterian churches in released time classes. And so various grades went to different churches during some years. And then that changed as the church population grew, and we had it in our own church. And now, today, I believe it's just down to being used for confirmation classes. Our own church, I think, even has completely gotten out of released time school as you know, a way of getting the children. And I guess I might move from there to the establishment of how the education department is organized in church. I think that the minister and probably secretary and superintendent of Sunday school ran the education when I first remember it, but a religious education board was established with a three-member body sometime during the 1950s, and it has now grown to a board of 9 members, and they started out with just maybe a volunteer person kind of directing the efforts, and worked toward getting a paid director of Christian education. There is the first one was Mary Maxson, who served the church for a good many years as a volunteer, and then finally 12 years as paid religious education director, and that was also half-time until quite recent times, and she was the first full-time person for the last several years of her tenure. This became my job upon her leaving in 1967, and mine was a part-time venture first and became full-time. Following my years in 1972, the three congregational churches in Fargo-Moorhead decided to hire one full-time person and hired Reverend Jim Bowler to do that for the three churches. And this existed that way for 4 years. In 1976, this changed again because the population of the Sunday schools began to decrease, and so did the budgeting for that kind of an item. So we went back to part-time religious education director. Linda Rice was the most recent director, and now we're back to the part-time involvement again. Then changing from that to some of the organization life of the church, I mentioned earlier that the women's organization was originally called Ladies' Union, and then during the years that I was growing up, became gradually changed. I think they had another name before Women's Fellowship, but that's what it's called today, mm-hmm. in between those years. And I think that the women's and men's clubs were strong, or stronger than they are today, during the years of my growing up, say in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, And now the men's club as such is not even active in our church. And during many years, they were pretty active in putting on several events for the church and doing some things. But the women have at least held together as an organization. They always had at least monthly meetings, and then they had circle groups of women who met monthly, as well as the fellowship group too. But in recent years, the fellowship now just meets once a quarter, or as special events come along, they do meet. Some of my fond memories about some of the things we did retreats and special meetings that we had following the guidelines of the state organization were some meetings that we planned to do, and one was held in the Oak Mound Church, a rural church north of Moorhead. I guess we haven't mentioned that in the development stage, but this congregation dates back almost as far as ours, and was at one time yoked to the First Congregational Church of Moorhead. Mm-hmm. Now they are a separate entity, but they have only a part-time minister. It was formed surrounding that rural school. There was an Oak Mound school and community, and a small church there, primarily of farm families. And in those days, I suppose 9 miles away from Moorhead was really far out.
Mm-hmm.
But the ministers in my growing up years began to serve that church also. It was a yoked parish. And anyway, they have a lovely building out there, and we held both a retreat now and then at their church in the fall, and in the summer we had even some vacation Bible school that we took out to their country church, because I thought it was kind of a nice setting for our children, a little different from the Moorhead setting for such a thing. The women in the years that I can remember, both growing up and as a young married person, undertook such large ventures as far as dinners are concerned. We regularly used to do dinners for 500 or 600 people, and they rarely do such a thing now. But they were projects that involved everyone in the church, of course, and they were big money raisers. They have done over the years many things to raise money for projects and for missions and so on, including such things as style shows and entertainments of, variety show type of things, and even to some dramas about the history of the church and so on. And they have done many things and still do occasionally now, the father-son banquets, mother-daughter banquets for the church. I guess, can you think of anything?
Suppose that is why the women perhaps still have a stronger organization or a knit group is because of the variety of activities they can do, as perhaps exposed to opposed to what the men do. You said that your women's groups have seemed to stay stronger than the groups that the men belong to?
I suppose so. Traditionally, we've seen a big change, of course, sociologically. Now the women, though they hold on to the groups and so on, I think the reason that they're not meeting as often and they aren't undertaking those big projects is that so many of them are in the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has changed their way of thinking.
And there are a lot of other things that they've become involved in,
yes,
both the men and the women,
mm-hmm,
and perhaps don't have as much time to devote to the...
Mm-hmm. The church has always encouraged, of course, community involvement, and felt that that's very important, as much as our giving to the church, that we should be involved in the
community organizations, and I suppose that's a big overlap too, in that many people have served in those other capacities in education and community service, health groups, and so on. I guess speaking about the groups, this is not directly related to education, but types of groups that are going on. During the years that in the 40s, there were quite active married couples groups, and in recent years now, it's called the ones and twos, to take it, to kind of take note of the fact that we aren't all, the total family unit, and to include singles as well as couples into their planning. So that's definitely something that's happened in recent years. Youth fellowships were called traditionally Pilgrim Fellowship in the Congregational Church, and still is. But in the great days of my growing up, they were organized both locally and state and national, and there still is that connection. But during the years that our children were growing up, my husband and I served as junior and senior high youth advisors, and I can remember many experiences of overnight retreats and doing all kinds of activities and work projects with the children. I guess one memorable thing that I remember about taking a group one winter time, we were going to spend an overnight in the Detroit Lakes area, and had contacted a camp about using their facilities, and they assured us that they were winterized. When we got there, somebody was new to the to the area, evidently, because what they meant by winterized was that there was a fireplace.
Oh my goodness!
In the cabin.
How cold was it?
And the night was down to below freezing. Oh. I know. And we got in there and tried to build fires, but there were, they were just it wasn't even insulated. You could wind whistle through the chinks, and many of the boys were hardy souls and thought they could manage with the sleeping bags and whatnot, but we had to give up and drive into the Detroit Lakes, and their church took us in overnight.
Oh,
we slept in the pews and whatnot, so that we had quite an experience. But
a lot different than turning up the thermostat at some of the camp buildings now.
Now many, in subsequent years, I was in a part of the confirmation retreats in the winter where we did go to a winterized facility, and that's really quite nice. But I thought about some of those experiences earlier where it wasn't. And that, I guess, that brings to mind the fact that, I don't know whether our church was unique, but in the days before the 60s even, our church really took a summer vacation. Sunday school was out for the summer, and still, they still are. And from that time, but even church gave its minister a month's vacation, and we didn't have
church. No one filled in.
We often, because there were two congregational churches in Fargo, they would cover for each other, or had a three-way proposition where one minister covered, went from one church to another, and maybe did several services, a Sunday, or else just invited them to come to the other one if you were in town.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And I think because, so many people were in the habit of going away and spending time at their lake places and vacationing and so on, that kind of shows even today, in that we aren't as full in attendance in the summer as we are in the wintertime.
When you were talking about going with your young people to these camps, do you think that there is as much family participation, especially in youth activities, now as there was back at the time that you were probably working when your family was that age?
I think it's not quite as much as it used to be, although I think that the state camping board and so on, they have planned some very unique things. They would be exotic as far as we were concerned, considering what they did in the early days. You know, they have such things as canoe camps and backpacking camps to Colorado and all kinds of very interesting work experiences.
Now, chaperones go with the young people when they do this, or do the whole families go, several sets of parents?
Probably more just the youth themselves, mm-hmm. With leaders, you know, mm-hmm. rather than a total family thing. Mm-hmm. Really, I guess the church doesn't cover the whole family in that way as they used to. Mm-hmm. They do have family camps, but I don't think they're as well attended, mm-hmm. at least by members of our church. They have had, I do remember, some all-church events just from our Moorhead Church, which, we spent a day or an overnight at the state church camp and planned meetings, you know, to plan mm-hmm. the year's events and so on.
How about overnight at your local church here?
Oh, yes, we've had some of those.
And where the families have come in and everyone has slept there. And
we haven't had the total family sleep in, but we have had, you know, various ages mm-hmm. of kids with parents, you know, some of them, uh-huh. or mainly the leaders as parents.
Then are the children given some responsibilities to, like, helping prepare the food and programs and
mm-hmm. food and programs. You know, many times the leaders will have planned program for them and so on. And typically, of course, we try to really fill the night so that there isn't, we know they're not going to sleep
not
very well. much. So things are mm-hmm. planned to make them wear themselves out, which they don't do as much as the adults.
Do you try to have a wide age range when you do that?
No, I think pretty typically it's been, say like a junior high one mm-hmm. or senior high or lower mm-hmm. down. They've had, even music camps and various types of things that have been interesting. I guess I might have mentioned it in a later time, but one interesting involvement was a dance choir, which one of the music leaders directed, that kind of movement type things that they would perform during worship services.
Interpretive
dance, mm-hmm. I guess they call it. And I really it might come under music, but they have had junior choirs or children's choirs for good many years. I mean, during the time that my children were growing up, they had a chance to belong to those youth choirs from early grades on up.
So actually there are a lot of opportunities for the whole family to participate.
To participate, yes. I feel
in
that
one
so.
Way or another.
Mm-hmm. That's changed over the years, but the youth have participated in many of the worship services, for example, and particularly we've always done the Easter sunrise service and youth Sunday services, things like that, in which there have been a wide variety of presentation, from drama to all kinds mm-hmm. of things. Some of the people were rather shocked, I think, to see contemporary music and things like that being used, because in the days that I remember back to the time of my wedding in 1949, for example, that only certain songs could be used and certain organ pieces and so on. We wouldn't have thought of, we asked, but we wouldn't have been allowed to have had the secular and some of the, you know, choices that people have now in the church.
That has changed a lot.
Music. Mm-hmm. Right.
Did you involve the youth in other activities in the church, such as ushering on various Sundays? Have they been brought in?
Yes. As a matter of fact, of course, they do even presently serve as ushers where they wish to, you know, at least from confirmation age up. Mm-hmm. I was just trying to think about their involvement. They do have had youth members on some of the boards, such as religious education and to the church council.
To get good input from their point of view.
Input. And then mm-hmm. there's a board comprised of half a task force for the youth activities, half youth membership and half adult membership, so that they're consulted in planning their activities.
Do they have their own officers for their own youth groups then, too?
Yes, they do. Because the children or the numbers have dropped in recent years, I suppose they're not as many. There aren't as many participating as there used to be, and I guess the increased competition for the children's time in various school and other things has reduced the amount of time that they or the their commitment to church groups that I saw in the. In the, say, the 40s to 60s, one item I didn't mention under the education was kind of interesting as I looked back in our church history, noticed that, and I do remember it really, at the time in the 30s, that the migrant workers began to come to the Moorhead area, and our Reverend Clues was very interested in the situation or the plight of the children that came along with them, and offered a pilot project, really, a migrant education, and I invited them into our church for a couple of summers before the Catholic Church really took on that program. And since then, of course, the Catholic Church took it over, and now there's quite a complete migrant education through the public schools, even, so that is held now in Edison School every summer.
Was that for full days then?
They took them in, I believe, for most of the day because
5 days a week.
Because the parents, mm-hmm. of course, were out mm-hmm. working the mm-hmm. total day. But it was quite an undertaking, and looked on with mixed feelings. I think some people wondered why on earth we would do that. But
a lot of the youngsters, I suppose, didn't speak English, and so it.
Very true, more so in those days
than
today. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And of course, there weren't the great numbers in those days either, people that came. But they were, unfortunately, they weren't allowed into schools in many places, most places that they went. And just as a matter of record, Minnesota was the first to ever allow migrants to enter schools.
That was interesting, and it was started mm-hmm. through the churches then mm-hmm. to help them out.
To help them out, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we're at the kind of end of a topic here, or if we were talking a little bit about things in the worship experience, I think, next, weren't we?
Yeah.
I was going to go on to say something about that there's evolved over the years, I think, more lay participation, because growing up, I remember that it was rare when a lay person really said anything from the pulpit or took part, really. He might have made an announcement or two. But gradually, we do use today lay leaders along with the minister to present things every Sunday, or most Sundays. And regularly, stewardship committees and others, participate in presentations in church, or even they do have lay Sundays and youth Sundays and so on, in which the minister might not even take part.
When they would serve communion long ago, was it just the minister that would participate also at that time, or were lay people
When you mentioned that, I think that he did do the total thing.
It seemed to be sacred mm-hmm. ground, the area of the pulpit.
Right.
And
women prepared the elements, mm-hmm. I think, in those days, but they didn't serve it. And now I think people were somewhat shocked, even when we have now men and women ushers, for example, in recent years, and that, you know, both men and women help serve communion and so on. I guess I was also thinking in the area of church music. My husband and I were longtime members of the choir and enjoyed that association. And I think one time when I was in high school, before the church was remodeled, the choir sat at an angle and faced the congregation directly. And it was so crowded at times up there that we wondered if people would get by without some catastrophe. I think it was a Sunday where it was, you know, there was big participation, something like Palm Sunday. They had brought up the offerings and so on and set them on the table between the choir members, and the whole table with all the money dumped on the floor. And I think that was a big impetus toward, you know, it convinced some people that we better, you know, renovate and remodel the sanctuary. It just seemed to bring matters to a head. But anyway, in speaking about the changes in music, the choir has always, I guess, been open to many kinds of music, but I think that they've used a lot of different instruments than they used to. But one thing unique to our church was we had an older couple, T.I. and Bessie Lewis, where he was a founding member, and she was, I think, church organist for, something like 40 years at least. But the old organ that she played was a little reed foot pump organ. And for years after we got the pipe organ in church, that was pushed around from place to place in church and so on. But in just 3 years ago, a committee decided that was really well worth refurbishing, and so they undertook to completely redo it. And it's now in the lounge area in church, and it's used on occasion, you know, and is really in mint condition.
Was that something that could be done locally?
I think that they had a local man, Lance Johnson, I know, worked on that organ.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm not so sure just who actually did the work on the reed organ. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting because I remember that old couple, long after the years when she did play it, on occasion they would bring that little organ up to the chancel and have her play. And he sang in the choir into his 80s and so on, and quite a remarkable situation.
Are there very many people that can play that reed organ?
Well, it isn't so very hard to play, you know, to play it well, that's another matter, but, you know, you can pump with your feet and play an ordinary little tune, and it has many stops, and, you know.
That's easy to...
You know how to... work those, that's where the skill comes in.
That's what I was thinking, to keep the pumping and working the little dealies.
Working those little stops.
I know that there was a very special pet project that you enjoyed so much. Perhaps you could tell us about that.
I guess this was in the realm of the ecumenical efforts, Bonnie, but one of my fondest experiences is in 1969-70, beginning to talk with some of my cohorts in the other churches about religious education and the things we had in common. So it culminated in a couple of years' experiences in the summer of doing 10 church cooperation on summer vacation school. And we titled our one in 1970 Kids Neighborhood Groups. And that was rather a unique experience, because the people on the steering committee represented those churches, and there were there was an involvement of, say, 50 or more leaders and teachers. We trained together and then spent several sessions in writing and organizing the effort. Basically, the premise lent itself to ecumenical work because of the theme itself, and we had the groups which met in different neighborhoods around town, taught by groups from, leadership of various churches, and invited in people, to register, but anybody else could come in too, to discover what was unique about their own neighborhoods that they were located in, and to even interview people and decide what things they could do to help somebody in the neighborhood and kind of broaden their scope a little bit, and ending with the final project of meeting together for a family picnic and kind of a survey of the things that have gone on during the week. We followed this up the following year by having the same, it's a somewhat similar experience, but doing this all at Gooseberry Park in Moorhead, and instead of locating in neighborhoods, the groups were dispersed all through the park by different kinds of titles of areas. For example, some people studied the Indian contribution to religion and some things about the outdoors, and then they could switch activities and participate in several during the day. And this also was interesting from the standpoint of putting together music and joint singing. In the first effort, we had traveling bands of high school age children who went about carrying out the music in the different groups that were assembled in the neighborhoods and so on. I don't know why I haven't really heard about this kind of effort since that time, and though it was quite a bit of work, it was very satisfying to see how much we really had in common working together on a project like this.
About how many young people do you think that you got involved in that period of time that you had these groups?
Well, I believe that the story in the paper said that there were nearly 400 who participated in the neighborhood group one, and I think as many the next year.
In that age range would be
the
what?
Age range was really about 5 years old through sixth grade in the teaching part.
Well, I bet they would really miss it if it didn't continue.
As far as I know, it didn't continue, mm-hmm. but I'm sure other churches are doing similar novel things and carrying on that sort of work. I think that in these youth events, our churches have talked together over various years, but in my memory, we carried on some group discussions and events with other church groups in Moorhead and Fargo, and notably I remember some with the Presbyterian and Methodist here in Moorhead, where our youth got together at the various church settings and did some programs and retreats. Then traditionally the churches have combined for Good Friday services in Moorhead. I'm trying to think of the name of the group that, Church Women United and some of those organizations have helped to, cross the boundaries of churches because they have had interesting programs. I don't know whether they're really as active right now in Moorhead. They disbanded for a while, didn't they?
There are groups meeting, but not on a regular basis, mm-hmm. as far as I know.
Because they used to regularly rotate going mm-hmm. to the many churches in town, and do still on occasion, I think.
Yes.
The World of Prayer and some of those are still carried on.
Which includes all of the various religions.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Thanksgiving mm-hmm. services are rather special to the Congregational Church in that we kind of base our background in America on the Pilgrim tradition. And of which the Congregational Church was founded. So we've kind of made more of that in recent years, and we have the three churches in town, the United Church, have gotten together for that kind of a celebration at Thanksgiving time. And I believe, you know, it's kind of interesting over the years, because I can remember when I was growing up, when memberships were not very big in many of the churches in Moorhead, much talk about going together, because in the Depression years they were all struggling so. And then many of the churches, you know, blossomed and grew in membership in the 50s and 60s. And I think now the memberships are struggling a little bit more to keep up to what they were. And there's been considerable talk about joining forces, and there's always a faction that does not want to go for this. But I think many of the lay people involved are rather interested in this. And I guess it's been interesting to me to see developments along that line. That I was interested to hear about the churches like at West Fargo now, who are big Catholic and Lutheran churches, have joined in the same building side by side. And it seems to me to make sense. And I know of many communities where churches have built and then shared facilities with more than one denomination. And I would see that maybe being a trend in the future. In the Congregational Church in Moorhead, membership made a rather slow but steady growth until a boom in the 50s, and it reached a top of 700 members, and gradually has gone down until it's just a little under 500 right now. I sense that it'll probably level off, maybe making slight gains. In the 50s, or almost shortly after we expanded our own church, there was talk of building a second church, and they almost bought property in the south of Moorhead to trying to make a decision of whether they should leave the present building because it was getting old, or build a new church and maybe even make a second church. And in retrospect, I guess it's a good thing they didn't, the way the membership went, but they decided instead to really update and restore our building. And it, in the survey of the historic buildings in town, has been put on that register. It is not the state historical society property like the Episcopal Church on 8th Street in Moorhead, but it is kind of unique of its time, I guess, and now has been at least restored to pretty good condition and refurbished, you know.
You mentioned that they like to utilize the church building itself as much as possible. Now, I know a lot of the churches are using their building for community events because mm-hmm. they feel that the building should be used more than just for religious purposes, mm-hmm. such as Boy Scout meetings,
yes.
and do you have that sort of thing at your church?
We at least like to encourage that. There's a unit of lay women and voters who meet it regularly mm-hmm. in our church. The beginning of the Volunteers for Community Service was in their office was in our church for several years. And now at present I know that we do the preschool hearing and vision tests are done in the church facilities for Moorhead schools, and the there's a group of the Alcoholics Anonymous that meets weekly in the church building. They do like to encourage other groups to make use of the facility. Trying to think if there are any others.
It makes sense when the building is heated in there and the room is available to this more open door policy with the churches has brought about more community participation.
Yes. I guess I would like to talk a little bit about some involvement that I had on the area and state lay life committees. It involved my participation, on a little wider level than just Moorhead, but one event that we did in the course of this time was a retreat in Holiday Inn for families or groups from the churches in our area of the congregational denomination. And this was kind of, I guess, kind of a departure. I think it's rather a common thing now, but we chose a wintertime meeting, and the setting there brought people in there to both enjoy the facility and to meet together out of their usual church setting to see that they could enjoy that also.
This concludes the interview with Marilyn, and I sure thank you for taking the time to give this information on your experiences during your religious life in Moorhead. Thank you so much.